Welcome to Saha Says, where we go over the headlines of the week and share our in-the-weeds opinions. Joining us tonight is Vesh, who is the security engineer and Saha moderator. Pinky is with us. She's the team captain for UTSA's Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition. And we've got Coop, who's a biohacker and our news curator. And I, myself, I'm Sciatic Nerd, B-Sides SATX coordinator and podcast manager. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. And we're going to open it up with Vesh's take on a story about the DoD.
Well, I don't know how much of a story it is because it comes from Coalition for a Prosperous America, which is just a group, that it says we need to shut down pretty much all manufacturing overseas and come here. It's led by Farmers Union, the Teamsters Union, you know, your typical anti, I would say protectionist, but they are very anti. I mean, they want to put money in their own coffers, so you know, take it for what it's worth. But they are very concerned that there is the last trusted foundry, or one of the last trusted foundries, which is a place where chips are created that have a very strict, they're strictly controlled. They are tested to make sure that there's no backdoors, nothing built in there that could later be used to compromise the machine that they're put in. So the DoD has these trusted foundries, and one of them just got bought by basically a foreign firm, and they're, you know, ringing all the typical bells and everything about what happens with a Chinese chip in one of our fighter jets.
Sure.
And which is a valid concern, but my post to that would be, you know, so what are you going to get by excluding Chinese manufacturers, these other manufacturers? We're not exactly, you know, our war with China isn't exactly the same as our war with Russia. There is a heavy amount of economic interdependence there, and that's why there hasn't been an all-out, you know, fight between the regions, between us and China. You know, we are economically interdependent, so I would rather have the economic interdependence preventing us from going to any wars than I would us worrying about these trusted chips going into systems and machines. It's silly that.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
It's just another thing that we have to worry about when we're just cranking out one plane after another or one system after another, saying, well, did anybody consider maybe just not making as many? You know, if it's going to be too expensive or too pricey, why don't we just not make as many? You know, do we really need all of these planes? Boeing and, of course, Lockheed would tell you, absolutely, we need, as a matter of fact, we need 10 times more than that.
Right.
But my viewpoint is, look, if you can't afford them, don't build them. We don't, you know, we need to scale back anyways. So what better argument is there than, well, you know, we can't go to war this week with another country because we don't have the right amount of planes. I think that's a perfectly suitable point of view to have.
Well, okay, so hold on, though. But I mean, the idea of making trusted chips, if we take a different viewpoint, maybe it isn't. But from where I'm sitting, the idea that I don't want to buy a piece of tech that I have to be concerned about is actually has embedded malware in it that's going to start siphoning off some data when I'm not paying attention to a different, you know, foreign nation. Whether or not we think that, depending on how tight our tinfoil underoos is, and we start to worry about whether or not our telephones, televisions, wireless speaker systems are already listening to us. I'd rather not be concerned regarding what's in the tech that I own. I actually would push for the idea that if I'm building something that's supposed to be in a can't go wrong system, let's say it helps drive a heavy piece of machinery, I would not want that piece of machinery to suddenly be able to be remotely controlled by something else or to be offering telemetry data, whether it's a backhoe or it's a machine that's moving, you know, something else, whether it's a machine that can throw a projectile half a mile. The point being that I'd rather know that the tech we're producing, even if it's more expensive, is more trusted or trustworthy, as opposed to saying, oh, I could buy a cheap chip. It's produced in inexpensively in another country, and we can import it, load it in, and isn't that wonderful? Which is, you know, half the concern I've had for years about, look, we've come up with an even less expensive Bluetooth headphone or an even less expensive Bluetooth project, or not Bluetooth, FPGA project board that was produced offshore. And then you come to find out that, oh, look, it's been quietly leaking data at random intervals. And that was only a month ago.
Well, that's the balance, is that people, we find these things out pretty quickly that it's leaking data, it's offloading data, that's a marketplace function, and some Apple things are getting pulled back over here because they're worried about Chinese espionage, people ripping off their products. So that's the, you know, the ebb and flow of the marketplace. You know, whether or not we want to keep throwing money at trusted foundries instead of just scaling back is a little bit, you know, it's like dealing with a bridge that you have to cross, but the bridge is 10 miles down the road and you could have fixed the problem before you left town. So that's what I'm saying.
But also we all need to think of it as more of an issue as we lean more and more about taking the human out of the equation. If we take the pilot out of the plane and put him behind a joystick, you know, halfway across the world through, you know, automation, what have you, isn't that much more of an issue that somebody could hijack it, what have you? And we would want to have more encryption, more trusted chips, less likely to have a back door in the device. You know,
well, that would be a bigger
concern to me.
Well, that doesn't draw away from my greater point that is just, you know, how about not having to go and build these planes as much as we do? So if we're so darn worried, if the cost is the driver, why don't we draw back on the volume? You know, and the same thing goes for all manner of plane, whether it's drones, whether it's F-35s, whether it's F-16, well, not F-16 so much, but F-22s. That's what we have to do. So that's my point, and it follows for every variety of item we have to buy with a chip, not just this one instance of planes.
Sure.
So.
Well, but this might just
That's my piece. No, that's my piece. I was just closing.
This might be my naive viewpoint on all this, but to be honest, this all sounds like it could be a quality control issue. We should be able to possibly look at the specs and try to figure out, hey, you know, does this have some capability to spy on us and leak data? And if we're not even doing that on our end, and if we're not going to do that on Chinese end, let's put our tinfoil hats, you know, super on and say, what's stopping an insider threat over here just screwing it up, you know, for one batch? They're, you know, spying on our data ourselves. And maybe they're selling it to China for us because we refuse to contract it out.
Yeah, we can't keep we can't keep somebody who literally worked, a Chinese national, literally working in China. We can't prevent them from working on the OPM contract, you know, the breach. So why are we saying that, oh, we think we can do this better in-house? They're just going to send spies in there too. So exactly. How about you just have the quality control, you know, on our end? And if you see somebody trying to obscure the functionality of a device, especially for a chip, comes out pretty quickly. You know, you see
I wish that were true. Okay, go ahead.
I'm talking about obfuscation, right? If somebody is purposely obfuscating the code, especially when it gets down to kind of a chip level and the obfuscating the functionality of the chip, it's fairly obvious when there's like, why does this gate keep feeding into this one, shift, and then back? That seems unnecessary. Those, like, you can see unnecessary operations in there and unnecessary, you know, just like through a quality control process, you could see all of this. Like, just the same way why I would be suspicious of any program I got where there was a section of undecipherable code.
Sure. Well, and you don't get to see what's behind the curtain there. But there's also, look, I can say with some certainty after reading certain articles that it's at least reported that sometimes there is a more than a chain of evidence length of time. There's more than, you know, it takes time for designs to change, to be implemented, to change vendors. It takes a lot of effort to say, okay, I've got something that works, but now I've got to go back. I've got to go back, and the one I've got that I thought worked beautifully, it turns out that one happens to be from an offshore company, and there's a risk of something going on in there. Where I've heard some outstanding articles, for example, from security hardware manufacturers, and you can order these great, it'll run things like pfSense, right? And so it's made offshore, it gets great write-ups and reviews from people in the community, but then I am forced to wonder, okay, so when it comes to security, how much am I willing to trust? I mean, that's really where you start to get the tinfoil hat tightening, and you know, it's harder to notice that you got a little bit of bleeding going on because you don't know where the line is. It's not just obfuscated code. It's whether or not we actually have, proper protections in place to let, to know that, okay, all of this code has been checked. It was done open source only, for example. But once someone takes it behind the scenes to use it in a serious context, sometimes proprietary stuff gets changed and you don't get to do a code review. I mean, how are you going to be able to do that low-level measurement on the chip, right? Vesh, isn't that what you're talking about? You're saying, yeah, well, we can tell pretty quickly if what we expect there to be is not the way it operates. How do we know that that's how that goes?
Well, because they're going to have, I mean, they're going to have a certain schematic that comes along with them. You know, anybody who's fulfilling these gigantic contracts is going to have some type of pinout or diagram or things like that. And we can always decap the chip and see the logic. We don't have to. And that's just part of quality control saying, okay, this batch of chips, I got 100 in. I'm going to take 3 of them and go through the process of examining them, 3 at random.
Proper QC, so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So why do we need to have, I mean, I understand the Trusted Foundry and everything, but these, I mean, expensive for what we're going to get out of it. And we need to stop. We basically need to just rely on the fact that if we go away or China goes away or something, there's going to be an economic domino effect and say, look, the reality is, why don't we just increase who we have economic reliances with? Like, mm-hmm. Who's depending on us economically? Who's depending on China economically, or Russia, or any one of these adversaries? And then we can sit back and go, they're never going to attack us because they count on us for 90% of their software development, or something like that. That's my thing, and just these trusted foundries are just these ways of closing off certain sections of the marketplace to, you know, global whatever
competition,
global scales.
Right? But I mean, at the same time, when you look at it, it's in a lot of ways it comes down to corporate espionage. It comes down to secrets, trade secrets, you know, like patents. Yeah. And speaking of patents, Yahoo is unloading 3,000 of them, and apparently it's going to be a fire sale. So, this article from Ars Technica from this month says that bids are being accepted for nearly 3,000 Yahoo patents and pending applications, according to the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Ars Technica, for citing the journal. News of the patent sale came late yesterday, not long after it was reported that Verizon is submitting a $3 billion with a B bid for Yahoo's core internet business. The sale of the core web business will include 500 U.S. patents and more than 600 pending patent applications, separate from the larger group going in the standalone patent sale. I mean, man, talk about just huge piles of IP just moving around. Now, I know that's not always the most exciting, sexy conversation to have, but okay, does this just feel like this is one of the last straws, the parting out of Yahoo, we're finally done with this beast, because it has been the hydra that will not die since the 90s. From the time that it used to be Yahoo with a catchy little yodeler in the ad, if you can say catchy and yodeler in the same sentence and not get stoned, there just needs to be an understanding that Yahoo has been, how has it made money over the last few years? Is it just a front financing laundering corporation at this point? It's a search engine ostensibly, but really, is it searching for a way to monetize itself? I don't know. Coop, when was the last time you actually searched with Yahoo?
I don't know really if anybody on this podcast actually was driving then. As a bad joke, because it was probably in the 90s the last time I really used Yahoo.
I use it every year for fantasy football. It has a phenomenal fantasy football interface.
Oh, there you go. So,
really?
That's the highlight of Yahoo. That's the only reason I still have a Yahoo email address. So,
and
I don't answer anything that goes to it, but I have it.
Great. Welcome to Yahoo. Everyone needs a dump account. No, I'm kidding.
Actually, everyone does.
It's just an old email. It was like my first personal email account. So, but this patent sale, Garb, this is just going to chum the waters for, you know, all the groups already have the patents that they want in their sites. And I think this is a continuation of the quote unquote failure that everybody thinks Marissa Mayer coming over there was. I said, and I'm going, well, she's was there to set it up so that it could be parted out. It's not at least as far as I thought. So if they're selling off their patents and they're getting as much money from their core internet business, that's like responsible liquidation. They're trying to get the most bang for the buck for their shareholders before they close the doors. So this is kind of typical, but it's way better than like a WorldCom situation or one of those other ones where it was just, there was just lies and cookbooks and, or suspected cookbooks and, different items there. But this is going to be, there are going to be so much patent litigation that results out of this, maybe not as much as the Nortel stuff, because it was older and Yahoo's not that old, but some of those initial internet patents that have to deal with, searching or crawling or displaying things in the World Wide Web, or maybe some electronic mail patents, items like that, you know, how to format it in the web face. I'm not saying that Yahoo has these patents. I'm saying that who knows what exists in this pile of 3,000 patents, and some of them could be used as like a hammer over other businesses.
And that's actually a part of what is interesting. I was going to make a horrible joke about, you know, hey, look, I didn't know Yahoo had a deal of the day. Apparently, it's 3,000 patents. And that's not funny, because the reality is that there's probably some very valuable IP in there.
Was that listed on Amazon?
No. I'm saying that they were starting their own deal of the day website, unfortunately. And it would be.
They should have it on Woot. More people would actually see it. Yeah, Woodoff for all the 3,000 patents.
That's right. And I'd love to see it. And coming up next, patent number 12365.G. What? Yes, it's that one. The one you've been looking for. The one with the funny socks. It's the patent you've been looking for. Have you got your allowance money together? Because it'll only cost you $1.6 million. Maybe not. Pinky, have you gotten your name in a patent yet? Just curious. You never know, folks. Folks have all kinds of creative ways of getting their outlets going.
I'm possibly going to be having a patent in the next year or two. I'm still deciding whether or not I want to go down that route.
And will you put all of your search engine optimization so that Yahoo can help publicize it for you?
No, thank you. I'd rather it be successful rather than a failure like this.
Ouch. Coop, how about yourself?
No, I don't have any patents in the works, and yeah, I think I would probably need quite a bit of help before I'd be able to put one out. You know, we'll see. I don't think tinfoil is in that allotment.
Probably not, but I mean, so there's always a risk of patent trolling going on, and usually it's the long tail problem where people just start to pick at the bones of an idea and chase down small businesses, and it should be considered in some ways, I think, some kind of crime. But actually,
remember with patents and acquiring patents, if you publish before, you know, you have the patent or whatever, you are at risk of not being able to patent your idea because you've already published it. So
oh, wow.
that's, So that's something to consider. I've had three or four things that I believe were patentable.
Oh.
And instead I just published. I mean, that's all I did. I just published them.
Okay.
I don't care. I hate patents, and I want to be logically consistent with my with what I do.
Okay, so now I do want to back up another step here, because I was trying to lighten that mood, but now I'm sincerely curious. What since you've released it into the public eye, what kind of things were you looking at?
It was the three, and I've done Saha talks on this. The 3D visualization of different computer data that at one time was something that I pitched to DARPA, and they were interested. I got a lot of callbacks, and the company I was with at the time really screwed the pooch by trying to bundle it with a bunch of other stuff, and really, really screwed the package there. So I never filed it, and I uploaded the tarball somewhere. I forget now. The malware stuff, when I did it and how I did it, was could have probably been worked into a patent. It would have been a little bit difficult, but I probably could have been worked in there. There was a code coverage item that myself and a couple other people made, and the system in its entirety probably could have been patented. And there's a couple other things, but I can't remember them off the top of my head.
Well, you know, that's actually fascinating, though. And I mean, it's amazing that there's that's really awesome, actually, because I understand you have strong reservations regarding the patent system. But I have to say that it's amazing that you've obviously worked out some things that are that intricate that have earned their way to be. They should be there based on the way our system works. Now, whether or not we agree with it, it's the fact that it is intricate enough and probably could stand to have been done. But I used to think a patent, honestly, was something that you did to protect yourself. However, it's turning out more and more like it doesn't seem to work out that way. And this is probably what leads to your reservations, is that it does not work as advertised.
Well, my reservation is that it leads to monopolies, and monopolies in the traditional sense, meaning that something that by virtue of its relationship with the government is allowed to operate in a space that that their competitors just are banned from. So, you know, kind of like local telcos, right? You know, you can't set up, a lot of times cities set up one telco provider in one city and then ban all the others. So that's what I hate here, is that these are basically, patents are basically monopolies on ideas, and you know, you shouldn't have a monopoly on an idea. I guess if you really wanted to argue for a patent system, you could say, no, you have to have a demonstrable prototype that exists and does exactly what you say it does, and it has to be on the market before you can patent it.
Wow.
So that's what I would say. A patent should be something very difficult to get, and you should only get one shot at it. You shouldn't be able to resubmit with a different name and just get a different patent attorney, and then it's all gravy.
Well, see, that's one of those things. It's intended in some ways to prevent some kind of counterfeiting or theft, which leads us into the next article, actually, which is that gaming industry looks like it's going to be the target, or at least thought of to be the target of some cybersecurity issues. Right, Pinky?
Definitely. So this article is from TechCrunch, and it was published like 4 days ago. And basically it's saying, you know, video games have been around for quite a while. I don't know how many of you guys are gamers. I'm definitely one. And in particular, this article is concentrating on Origin and Steam. Basically, they're mentioning that there's been a recent wave of malware attacks against Steam, who's the leading digital entertainment distribution platform for PC. And they're showing how game-related crime has changed in the last few years. And I don't know if I really want to concentrate so much on the fact that, you know, there's malware being developed for Steam, because in that regard, it's just another application out there that is, you know, desirable, because there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of users on Steam. And just recently, 77,000 Steam accounts are apparently stolen every month.
Wow.
So obviously it's, you know, a desirable market. But to me, this isn't new news. If we think about 2 years ago, there was a DDoS against, you know, Xbox Live on Christmas Day.
Yeah, yeah.
A few years ago was the big Sony hack and Sony hack number two. And those were huge hacks. I mean, especially with Sony. So I don't know why.
It was a PSN hack.
Yeah.
I think we should specify the PSN hack. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. My bad. But, you know, this is not new news, and just the fact that now we're targeting the PC arena is not a big surprise. If you've been paying attention to the gaming news at all, this was just the next step.
Well,
I guarantee you every single one of those Steam accounts that was stolen had an enabled two-factor authentication.
Well, so this goes back to the exact same story in a way as last week's episode, where we described that people should work on better passwords, and I know that seems really obvious. However, there has to be, we have to do something, people. There's a website called 2fa.org, I believe it is, that actually talks about all the different apps across all platforms that have some form of two-factor. And one of the things I really appreciate about 2fa.org, is that they allow you to send an email almost, you know, to spam the people from that site, regarding whether or not they've actually, if it doesn't have the feature, you can go back and ask for it to be added. And, I think this is an amazing idea. Some way of getting to it. I'm slightly wrong. It's called twofactorauth.org. Twofactorauth.org. And, this is
at the number two,
Spelled out actually. Thank you. TWOfactorauth, all one word, .org. And you can look through all the different applications. And even though you have the ability to turn on two-factor, so many people still don't have it turned on. It's if you've never done it before, it seems a little confusing at first that you have to pick a device to be your effective key, your additional layer of protection, among other things. But there are a number of ways to apply two-factor. Coop, what's your current favorite way of doing two-factor?
The YubiKey, really.
Nice. What's your favorite thing about the YubiKey?
Open source, easily adaptable. I can use it with Google, use it with operating system, what have you. And if you buy a higher capability key, you can use it through NFC, Bluetooth, what have you. It just, you know, I can use it on my phone, everything. It just becomes very useful, but also, you know, you could say then becomes the key to the kingdom, and you got to protect it.
Absolutely. Pinky, do you have a preferred two-factor method or device?
I don't necessarily have a preferred one. I generally use whatever application I has, you know, wants you to use. I'm noticing there's a strong trend switching to Duo, and I am liking Duo so far. I use it for a few different of my accounts, and it has really good smartphone integration, works with the Apple Watch, and it's just really quick, easy to use, easy to set up.
Nice. How about you, Vesh?
I like smart cards just because I don't know enough about the YubiKey, and so with the smart card, the entire cryptographic processor and everything, it's like a mini operating system that exists on that device. So, and I know more about the smart card. If the YubiKey has the same thing, or if it's just, you know, if it's like a separate processing unit with its own memory and everything, I'm cool with it. But if it's something where it's just another method of authentication versus an actual separated cryptographic processor like what you can get in a smart card. Plus with a smart card, you can have SSH keys, you can have all sorts of different extended keys, you can have certificates and all that stuff on there. So I think that smart cards are more mature, and I think a YubiKey is effectively no better than a phone with Duo on it.
And in a way, I think I agree with you. And just to circle back around to make sure we mention our sources a little bit, the Duo Security Two-Factor and Endpoint Security System is by Duo, as in Duo.com. And do you have one you want to point out for the smart card, Vesh? Or I've already got one pulled up. It's just up to you.
The Aventra stuff.
And so that's something you can probably order online, right? Just pull it on up and give it an order. It's not expensive.
Yeah, you have to. You're gonna have to set up. See, that's what kind of discourages people from the smart card stuff is that with the YubiKeys, you don't really set up your own private kind of cryptographic system like you do with smart cards. You set up the, you know, the CA, and then you set up the certificates and what all the functionality within those certificates are. It's much easier to, or it's integrated for logon. It's integrated for, or you can use it for logon. You can use it for SSH. You can use it for encryption, digital signing.
Right.
All of those features. No. And you can do it all yourself. You can put the thing on the smart card, lock it yourself, and then that's it. Game, set, match. You're fine. So, and all of that is controlled by you.
And so that's Aventra. And that's Aventra.fi, AVENTRA.fi. So just pointing out that you can go look it up there and you can actually buy them online if you know what to call them. It's actually not that hard. I ordered four of them for about $20 or so, $25. Took a few days to get here. And just like Vesh is saying, you can then set up all the tools yourself. It's going to take a little bit of legwork, but then so does everything. You know, it's always that balance for security, isn't it? The balance between effort versus protection or convenience, if you will, versus security. And so this is no different.
Plus, with the Aventra, you can actually get in there the NFC stuff so that you can use it for your logon, you can use it for your access. So you can kind of take this card and use it for everything. That way you reduce the shit that's in your wallet.
And anything that can make the wallet less bulky, I'm kind of all for. Because if you've ever had the brick that gives you scoliosis before, or, you know, maybe you like that. I don't know. It's up to each person being different.
One more nifty thing about using smart cards is if you get really adept at creating Java card applets, you can have that smart card do all kinds of other stuff for you. You could have your own, you could have your own set of applications that have a very specific functionality that's geared to you and only exists on your card.
Oh, wow. So where do you learn how to program applets?
Gemalto, I think the Gemalto site has a good section of tutorials. You're going to need something like you can do it in Eclipse. It's the J2ME Java Micro Edition. That's all pretty much smart card development, sim chip development. So that's it.
Wow. So, well, the thing then to keep in mind is it's going to take a little bit of learning to maybe develop your own applets for cards. However, Coop, what's up next?
Well, talking about learning and using too often more security, looks like we've got another hack announced this week through techworm.net, published here on June 9th. Twitter was hacked, and a hacker is selling 32 million Twitter passwords on the dark web. And, you know, it looks like after the mega hacks of last month, it's now time for Twitter. But there is a twist in the news. It seems that Twitter was hijacked and the hacker managed to steal Twitter user IDs and passwords of 32 million users.
32 million. Sorry.
Yeah, 30 million with an M. And however, the news doesn't come from the dark web underground forums, but from legitimate data breach reporting website, which even offers you services of removing your username and password from the stolen database for free. According to TechCrunch, good that they're cited, the data comes from a Twitter hack in which 32 million user Twitter accounts may have been compromised. The incident and the news comes from rather an unusual source that lets you download such data and even lets you remove yourself from the listing for free.
Weird.
The website that seems to be making the most off its leaked source. The site reported same in a blog post stating that it received a copy of the data from a user called. And the funny part, if you've looked at the list a little bit, the most common password is 123456.
I'm sorry. It just hurts. Every time you read that, something that shows up somewhere, that is just a painful thing to hear. How many times do the people inside the echo chamber have to shout out loud, please make passwords that aren't the code to your luggage for the sake of all that is lockable? Do something to protect yourselves. My gosh. Vesh.
Use Spaceballs for that ongoing joke.
Absolutely. Vesh, talk to me here, man. Come on. I know you got to have it.
Well, once again, this is a two-factor auth situation. So, I mean, I have two-factor auth on my Twitter. But the other thing is, I don't know if somebody could go through and tell me how many of those were verified accounts, like the important kind of the important accounts, and or you know whatever Twitter deems to be an important account, and how many of those were it's a picture of some girl that somebody's got off the internet and put it in there like she's in like a racing tee or something like that, and saying looking for my next big adventure, and it's just one of those spam accounts where they're sending Gucci, you know, like links to fake Gucci bags. So I think considering the Twitter universe and how easy some of those passwords are versus, you know, who actually made the accounts, I'm gonna bet that this actual leak is compared to actual live Twitter users who use their accounts and got their stuff taken, I bet you the actual dump is much, much smaller.
Hey, and so a lot of these are spun up spam accounts anyway, basically. And hey, you want to learn how to spin up an extra 1,000 followers on your account?
Yeah, exactly. That's the. I mean, it's like robots stealing robots. It's just, you know, the cycle continues.
It's not Skynet, but it's an incredible simulation.
It's the world's dumbest Skynet.
Yeah, great. It's iRoomba. That's it. It's iRoomba. It's 1,000 vacuum cleaner robots carrying kitties. That can't be wrong.
That brings new meaning to sucking passwords, doesn't it?
Okay.
Too soon.
I endorse.
Too soon, Wendy.
Yes. And see, that right there, that's a great place for which to end the news. And instead, we'll move on to our Hacks of the Week, where we talk about the latest and strange that's been going on around the net. Like, for instance, were you a fan of Napster? Did you like to share files? Do you have Pirate Bay on speed dial? No, I don't know. I'm just making this up. Look, the actual Hacks of the Week include, we're going to kick off with an article from the Hacker News that basically, they make a nice big banner on here that says BitTorrent hacked. If I could go back and add echo to that word, BitTorrent hacked. Just funny somehow to me. It says, if you're a torrent lover and have registered on BitTorrent Community Forum website, then you may have already had your personal details compromised along with your hashed passwords. The BitTorrent team has announced that its community forums have been hacked, which exposed private information of hundreds of thousands of its users. As of now, BitTorrent is the most visited torrent client around the world with more than 150 million monthly active users. Besides this, BitTorrent also has a dedicated community forum that has over hundreds of thousands of registered members with numbers upon numbers. Basically, change your password. If you have a BitTorrent account, please go change your password when? Yesterday. No, not now. Yesterday. Two days ago. You're already so far in the back. It's the next season. Go. Right now. Hit pause. Go do it. I know, because most of the people, if you actually are kind enough to listen to this recording, then it's probable that you're in the middle of torrenting something right now while you're listening to this. Yeah, that's right. You're torrenting while you're driving. Because I firmly believe you need to see the first new episode of Top Gear, the British Top Gear, while you're driving. No. Because, you know, no, okay, yeah, see, that should elicit a response. Because the new show that's coming on Amazon, that will be the new Top Gear. That's not Top Gear.
You mean Gear Knobs?
Gear Knobs and Broomsticks? What? No.
Please use a VPN if you're torrenting.
You mean like Axion VPN, our first ever sponsor of this podcast?
Thank you, sponsor. Thank you.
We appreciate what you do. Axion VPN, your privacy and you. Anyway, so the actual funny part to me about BitTorrent getting hacked, it's yet another story where we could just retread the last 5 minutes of this entire podcast and it would apply exactly to this. Because you can't always protect the password stores, but you can make complex passwords and it's time to change them. So, Vesh, when did you, because I'm assuming you've moved on from BitTorrent, the straight-up client, what torrent tools do you use?
I use an old version of uTorrent that I run on a different system. So that's what I do. Because I went back and I find the one that doesn't have all the ads and everything in it, like when they were just making it and compiling it and pushing it out. And that's what I do. As long as it has encryption and all that, that's what I do. I'm not going to go and I could have sworn that the BitTorrent client had like a supply chain plant in there somewhere that was taking and putting into the code base something nefarious, not in like government nefarious, not God, I wish I remembered the source of that. I don't want to start a rumor, but I could have. I know that I read somewhere that the BitTorrent client had been, you know, similar, like the Tor thing. It was there was something there that was able to, that was doing something that you would not appreciate. So but as far as torrents go, you know, and I only use it to torrent Linux distributions. I don't know about anybody else. That's all I use it for, is to get, you know, new free BSD ISOs.
There you go. So, Pinky, I'm curious what you use it for, if you do. Are you a frequent user of torrent? If so, what clients? And do you actually have a custom client, or is it something, you know, like, do you compile fresh? Do you just use existing binaries? What's your preference?
So I don't really torrent that often. Again, if I do, it's for distros or maybe, you know, games or whatever, if I really need a patch update. When I do, since I'm generally on my Mac, I use Transmission, which maybe I shouldn't, because if I remember right, it was in the news like a month ago that it got Trojanized or some crap. And distro, I mean, you know, Linux, primarily, not Microsoft.
Sure.
A brief note in this article that I don't know if you noticed, the password, you know, they're hashed and everything, but they're salted with SHA-1. So can we just have a moment to laugh at that?
We have a moment of silence.
I didn't see that. That's good. That's good.
Somebody play taps on their phone for that.
Who the hell was using these forums anyways and putting their actual personal information in there? Like, if I would
Isn't that what the Yahoo's
scared.
For?
Yeah, exactly. All every single one of those BitTorrent users should never have to worry about their personal details being leaked, because they shouldn't have put personal details in a site that specifically talks about pirating downloads.
Right.
So
I'm pretty sure that folks are using a lot of anonymizing software or websites that kick out things like your Star Trek name, you know, and what would your Wookiee name be? Well, that's my login on torrent sites. Who knows? But still,
I use my porn star name at yahoo.com.
your torrent star name. .com. So no, okay, actually that's a brilliant citation there, Pinky. But so all users are strongly advised to change their forum passwords as well as passwords for other sites in case they were using the same password. Can we have a moment of silence for the repetitive use of the same password, please? Cuz if you're doing this, you're just helping the bad guys get to your stuff faster, whether or not it's actually legitimate data. So maybe some of these folks don't care. Maybe there's a dump accounts, like you were saying.
Well, speaking of like repetition, everything, just as a little side note, edited over the weekend that.
I'm sorry, you lost me, Mr. Robot. Please rewind.
Yeah, start that statement over, please.
You hacked society. What?
This redundant.
I'm sorry. No.
Never mind.
Okay, so take a minute. We're going to roll for a second. We'll come back to you in just a second. And I'm going to push to Pinky, go for the Mitsubishi Outlander car alarm.
Okay, sure. So, I mean, this might need another drinking game that I might have mentioned briefly, because yet another car has been hacked.
Oh, no.
This time it's been the theft alarm, you know, rather than just the entire car at least. But according to the hackernews.com, Mitsubishi Outlander's car theft alarm has been hacked through Wi-Fi. So, as I mentioned, from GPS system to satellite radio to wireless locks, today's vehicles are more connected to networks than ever, so they are more hackable than ever. It is not new for security researchers to hack connected cars. You know, it was last DEFCON, I believe, was when we heard about the Chrysler and Tesla both had hacks. Tesla reacted a lot faster, but here's yet another hack of there was a Wi-Fi console. I don't know why we ever thought that was a great idea to throw Wi-Fis in cars. But, you know, there's Wi-Fi, so you can connect your Mitsubishi mobile app to this Wi-Fi and send commands to the car.
Wow.
Greatest idea ever.
Ever.
Oh, no, it gets better because it's difficult to upgrade access point firmware.
Oh,
so specific for a car. So that's like saying, oh yeah, I will put a gradually more and more outdated access point in model. and then I'll connect it. I will connect it to the other parts of the vehicle that drive the thing.
How is that even connected? That shouldn't even be remotely connected beyond that of one-way telemetry, so you can see that it's still moving forward. It should not be on the same system.
Well, if you notice, they use also Wi-Fi weak access security keys, and they cracked it through brute force, you know, in less than 4 days, not on the cloud. Just with, you know, 4 GPS, that's it.
Oh my gosh.
Jeez.
I love when these things come around, and they act like, oh my, look at these all-star hackers that did it. I'm like, okay, the first couple of people to do it, you know, Charlie Miller and,
yeah.
Was it Chris Valasek?
I forget. I can't.
Yeah, so those guys coming together, they actually did something, you know, kind of new in the arena. But I'm a little bit sick of talks and hacks that get published when the problem was that they're hacking an embedded system. No, they're hacking a system that has none of the traditional processor protections like today. They're hacking a system that has no SLR, you know, to randomize a memory layout. Sure. It has no stack protection. They're using old techniques against, you know, new systems that are really just old systems put somewhere different. So that's these guys keep getting this publicity, and it's starting to irk me. Saying it's not even a complicated hack most times. It's, oh, I brute forced the AP. Oh, I executed something against their HTTP or against their web server. And look, I got execution. Of course you got execution. It's a version of light HTTPD that's been deprecated for 17 years.
Yes. Yeah. And on embedded systems especially, this is a notoriously difficult problem to solve because that stuff does not get updated that fast. I mean, Coop, you yourself, you've tinkered on some of this stuff, right? I mean, I know you want to put some of this hardware in your vehicle, don't you? You mean you're telling me you're not going to hook up like an Internet of Things blender and toaster in your car, like through the cigarette lighter maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it just seems hilarious to me, all this talk about, you know, the simplest things to do being lifted up by the press as being master hackers at their best. It's like, are you kidding? Please let me put a couple of APs in my car and have a traveling Wi-Fi test range for the script kiddies out there. I'll even put WEP, WPA, WPA2 in there and see which one goes down, and then you can play in the sandbox all you want, because guess what? It's recorded. Please play in there all you want, and that'll give me a heck of a talk to give at Saha and AHA, and I'll submit it to a couple of cons for the fun of it. You know, it makes me want to just throw it together really fast, get it recording, and then drive that same car and park it at cons and what have you, and see what happens.
I think you have a way forward
can
here.
Can you imagine driving that out to like DEF CON and having it in the parking lot and see what people do to it? Because will I care if they hack it? No, I want it to be hacked. And it just sounds hilarious to me. That why does the press get all up in arms about this kind of crud when it's, like Vesh put it very technically, not that big a deal. That's the English translation of it. It's not that complicated, not that really awesome. So, where's the hack?
Well, the thing is the stories put the emphasis on the wrong thing. It's, look at these awesome hackers that are getting into your car. And it should just say, look at these people getting into your car. And then they never ask the question, well, why are we putting this in the car in the first place?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's what they never get to. And it's annoying.
And now, Pinky, I was curious. I know you recently had occasion to switch vehicles. By any chance, was it because of Wi-Fi access in the vehicle? You wanted to add it, didn't you? That was the main reason, right?
Oh, no. I will not buy a car that has Wi-Fi, because if you just look in the news, you're stupid to do so. No, I got rid of my car because in less than 3 years, I was on my third transmission.
Oh, wow.
Yahtzee.
Wow.
Yeah.
The hat
do
trick
not get
of
a Ford Fiesta.
Oh, okay.
Or Focus.
Wow. There you
and
go.
You're the same
I
engine.
Had a Focus. What year did you have? Mine, I loved mine.
Mine was a 2013. The problem started about 2012, 2011. Still happens with the new cars today. My radio also went out. It's also a known problem that cost at least $700.
Ooh.
I got lucky that my extended warranty repaired it. So just recently, I had the transmission replaced again. The time before that, my evaporator and radio were out, and that was a $5,000 repair if I didn't have extended warranty.
Oh my gosh. So you're saying you maybe you want the Wi-Fi hub in there so that there'd be a reason for a recall. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
It sounds like it already has enough reasons for recalls there. Oh, good
that's
God.
That's not a bad idea. It's like, yeah, I want the Wi-Fi access point so I can hack it and get the thing recalled.
Yeah.
Then I get a new maybe product. We can hack it and improve it.
So they can hack it and fix it.
Yes, exactly. Let's
please
fix it.
Please flash the computer in there that sucks in the first place.
No, actually, so I
had a,
yeah, go ahead.
I had a friend. I had a buddy who had a let's just call it a luxury car, and it had a turbocharger in it. Now, at 85 miles an hour, the turbocharger would go out and it would throw an error code. So what he did was he had a car code reader and editor. So all he did was see the parameters that would throw the error, and it was just they would have to take it up to 85, which nobody selling it to a dealership was, and the turbocharger was like a $10,000 repair. So all he did was go in there, clear the error, and go and trade it in.
Oh,
and so there's going to be new ways of turning in your car and actually getting a decent deal of it. You know, maybe we can get some high value employment at some of these car dealerships because they're going to want to review the car's computer to see if things have been reset or items like that, because they're not there yet, but we are. So maybe, so new tool, tip for you guys, get a car code thing or whatever, you know, hooks up to a CAN bus or I forget exactly what they're called, and then go and reset all those alarm codes.
Wow.
And make sure that your car is error free. So that way the idiot mechanic doesn't go, oh, well, I'm going to give you $5,000 less in your trade in because your check engine light's on. Just go in and clear it.
Wow. Have you ever actually done that without using the computer system where they used to, you could look up some of these. They're worse than Easter egg codes for Konami games on the old NES. I mean, it looks like you're doing some kind of bizarre dance, you know, with the left, with the turn signal arm and the brake pedals and things like that. It's a little strange.
I'm not saying do it all the time. I'm just saying do it right before you take it to the dealership.
Right. So I'm also curious if, before you go and do that at the dealership, Pinky, I'm wondering if you set up a honeypot so they actually, you know, is a form of having fun before turning it back in. Did you have a little fun with the dealership? No, I'm kidding. No, of course you didn't. That would have been silly.
I spent 3 hours bargaining instead and haggling, so no.
Okay, they're too busy to do it. I see how that is. See, because if you had been not haggling, maybe you would have, been talking about the universities paying hackers and crackers $20,000 to get back ransomware files. Vesh, did that actually happen?
The guy who posted the story from the Hacker News is the guy who started Hacker News. So, or it says his name was Mohit Kumar. Sorry if I'm butchering that name. Entrepreneur, hacker, speaker, founder, and CEO of the Hacker News and the Hackers Conference. I've never really heard of the Hackers Conference. And the Hacker News, I hope that it's the same, because I get Hacker News and the Hacker News, and I don't know if I'm remembering one and not the other. So take this thing with a
grain of salt. Got it.
I'm correct that he's correct that the University of Calgary in Alberta paid a ransom of $20,000 to decrypt their computer files and get access to their own email systems. You know, pay $20,000 to get immediate access. Ransomware guys, like, it's a market too. They tend to give you the decryption key.
Wow.
So just so that's what they want. They'll just give you the decryption key. So maybe instead of trying to track down every single one of these ransomware people, we should start kind of seeing some value in what they're doing, because what they're doing is they're actually applying a monetary figure to this is kind of a favor for those of us in security industry and running security companies, is that they're applying a dollar figure to different systems.
Yes.
So that's so there's value in that. Oh, so X amount of downtime in a university email system equates to they'll pay out $20,000. So we know now that email systems for this university, their uptime is worth $20,000 or the data contained therein.
So, okay, Coop, it looks like you've got something to add to that straight away. Go for it.
Yeah, I would kind of wonder what the IT guys, you know, at that college were thinking. Didn't they have like a backup of some of the systems? You know, what's their disaster plan? You know, not that, you know, saying some ransomware guy is a natural disaster, but, you know, possibly he is, and would give you a reason to back up your systems and your data. You know, I would hope that they would have a plan, or now they might think about making one. And I don't know. Do you guys have a nice backup plan for your stuff? At least your own personal stuff? If you were, you know, ransomwared, would you laugh at them and say, yeah, sure, no? Let me just wipe, burn it, kill it, and go back to my backup.
Yeah, I'm good.
Oh, I'm good usually within a week to 2 weeks. I'm usually pretty dang good, especially if I've seen there's been a big update.
I might be a little bit worse personally, but all the most important things I do, I have on the cloud anyway, mainly because I need to work on it at 3 different locations. So I'd wipe, I wouldn't pay for it. And maybe the university made the mistake of maybe they back up too often. I doubt it. It's more likely they didn't have a backup plan, or if they did, they're like, haha, it's some policy we'll never follow. So, you know, it's also make sure you don't back up too often and end up backing up the ransomware to your backup.
Yeah.
And then have another backup somewhere off-site, and, you know, that might save you, but how out of date is it going to be?
So
you're supposed to have a hot, to have hot, warm, and cold backups. I mean, you're supposed to have your backup tapes, which are your cold backups, your warm backups, which are your, you know, your disk drives that are in some other location, but they're easy. You know, they're sitting there waiting. They can be prompted to come back up. And then you have like your online, like an online NAS or something for your hot backup. So you're supposed to have like 3 different tiers, I guess is recommended, but you'll, you should be fine, you know, just with the warm backup, which is probably images kept on some ready disks that you have stored somewhere. So, but it's got to be online accessible somewhere. You have to be, you know, that's the concept of warm, is it's ready to go at the flip of a switch.
So Pinky, did you actually have more to add with that?
I just almost question if universities, you know, they're a weird sort, let's be honest. I mean, sure, I'm from one, but please don't take this to be any representation of my school, but my weird opinion. But generally, we're all procrastinators anyway.
Sure.
And I question, you know, do they properly back up, you know, with the plan that they should? I know, I have a feeling that I know of a few OITs that don't. Because anytime anything goes down, it takes forever and a day to come back up, and you might have lost data. So that makes me feel like we don't follow as much as we should.
Oh, I can say that for sure. There are plenty of situations. I actually had one personally that involved, yes, we have a backup cycle running and the tapes are rotated and all that jazz. And then come to find out it was pointing, it was about a year in, maybe 2 years in, and no one went back and checked the tapes apparently from the team. So when we did go back after a catastrophic fail on some hardware, they found that the tapes were empty, and it turns out that someone had pointed the backup system to the wrong folder. So they were backing up next to nothing every 2 to 3 days for the last year and a half, and it was a moment of true panic as we sought a lukewarm, tepid backup to not lose big time. And thankfully, there was an accidental success in there somewhere that led to us not losing some chunks of information. And in other cases, I've definitely, you know, you move in and tell people, look, here is a backup plan you can follow. Here's a website. Choose one. Choose a method. Take it. Here you go. Here are 2 hard drives. And maybe you buy 3 or 4 of them and you label them, for goodness sakes. Here's A, B, C, and D. And maybe, like Vesh was saying, you got one online, you got a couple offline, you got one off-site. And this is not just Vesh, this is not me, this is not none of us. Look at proper backup plans and rotations, like backup rotation plans. And the idea that you actually can label them and swap them out so that you have varying levels of protection in case there was, heaven forbid, a fire. There was, you know, okay, a catastrophic power failure, the platters go wrong, something. You've got a way to get yourself out of jail free, not just relying on SEP. And that's not just someone else's problem. I'm talking about someone else's portable gear. I'm talking about the cloud. It's an SEP. You should be able to know that where your data is and not just rely on someone else's equipment when it comes to that. But anyway, Coop, could you talk to us for a minute about the FTC's chief technologist?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Going back to ArsTechnica.com, talking about it's got a story here about FTC's chief technologist gets her mobile phone number hijacked by an ID thief. And it has here in a scenario that's growing increasingly common, the chief technologist of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission recently lost control of her smartphone after someone posing as her walked into a mobile phone store and hijacked her number. Details of the incident were provided by the FTC's Lori Cranor in a blog post published Tuesday morning with the headline, "Your mobile phone account could be hijacked by an ID thief." And in it, Cranor wrote, "A few weeks ago, an unknown person walked into a mobile phone store, claimed to be me, asked to upgrade my mobile phones, and walked out with two brand new iPhones assigned to my telephone numbers. My phones immediately stopped receiving calls. I was left with a large bill and the anxiety and fear of financial injury that spring from identity theft."
Wow.
This post describes her experiences as an ID theft victim, explains a growing problem of phone account hijacking, and suggests ways consumers and mobile phone carriers can help combat these scams.
So now, does this to you, I mean, does this say something to you as far as, all right, so even people at the highest of echelons are at risk?
Yeah, if it can happen to her, chances it's going to happen to more people. And you know, it even gives you four really good resources here. Identitytheft.gov, Fraud Alert.
Yeah, I don't think that, as much as I like to blame, you know, government officials for, stupidity, in this case, yeah, this is a scenario that could happen to anybody. I mean, walk in, fake ID, address checks out. You know what? You know how much intensity do you really want to review somebody who's just upgrading a couple of phones? I mean, I wouldn't even know where to put the two-factor auth in the equation here. I mean, I'm sure that there's some way to do it, but you're talking about a pretty large rollout across several stores to put it in there, and maybe eventually they'll put it in. But really, they don't lose all. They're not losing all that much money on these things, so it's not. Yeah, and if they knew the last four of her SSN, then I mean that's right. That's they went after her phones, so that's clear. They went after her phones. They went after her ID. That's what they did. So
right.
it was a lot of setup. There was a lot of setup involved here to get these particular phones to sell them for a profit. Almost so much so that I wonder what the actual profit was off of those phones, considering the cost of a fake ID, getting the social security number, going to and getting the phones, and the risk involved. Was it worth it? I mean, was it worth it for two top of the line iPhones on the black market? You're going to get less than retail for them. I mean, maybe activated.
What makes you think this was about the phones? What makes you think this was actually about the phones? What makes you think this wasn't a targeted? I did it because I can prove that I did it to the head of the FTC or the chief technologist of the FTC.
Looking through it, it was it explains in here that this seemed to be more of a identity theft item where they use that to grab some phones to sell. So rather than their
right, but that's what I'm getting at.
As they say, there's no evidence that the thief did anything with those phones, like made calls or anything for themselves. So, and since they used a fake ID, they're probably just going to want to unload those phones.
Maybe.
So nobody, I severely doubt that anybody is going to take credit for this and say, oh, look at how easy it was. It's like, do you know how many laws you broke?
That's right.
To get that?
To get you that know, and to whom you've done it. Someone who's definitely going to take steps.
To prove a point.
Right.
I would applaud anybody who did it, and I would think it.
Yeah, you definitely get Troll of the Week award if you do that, but I mean,
I just
seriously
wonder what kind of margin they're in these freaking phones to make this worth it.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. So I'm curious, Pinky, have you ever had your identity stolen?
Thankfully, no, and, you know, OPM tried their hardest to change that, but no. I saw some suspicious activity apparently almost in Dallas, but no.
Coop?
Well, working as a guy that used to work for one of the major carriers here in the States, you know, it just seems like there should have been more security on the account instead of, hi, what's your name? What's your address? Do you have picture ID? You know, what's the last four of your social? You know, there should be like some sort of password on the account and not be like, you know, social engineering your way past it saying, I'm sorry, I don't remember the password. Can I just give you my social? You know, there's no, you know, so many times that you probably would hear that I have in a store and, you know, I would not be able to help them because otherwise that would have been my job.
So I can say with certainty that I've had someone falsify data to change my phone service back in the 90s. Or no, yeah, it was the early 90s. And it was the idea that they used to call it phone slamming, and they basically would stop by door to door the apartment complexes, forge your signature, and then transfer your landline service at the time. But this would be no different. The change here is if they went ahead and they did an actual check of the physical ID, that there should be. I remember there used to be something in the old cell carrier I used to use. They would have a letter on file. You could add it. It wasn't by default. And letter on file, you had to go and write something in writing and present it to them. And they would supposedly have to confirm with the person who held the letter on file and call a number or something separately, which was intended to be not the cell number. It was intended to be a landline where you could reach a human to confirm. Now, again, that was goodness. That's been 15 years or more, but it seems like the time has come definitely for more companies to consider something like that. And I'm curious, Coop, have you ever actually had to respond to someone who called in with a fraudulent or having been the victim of identity theft? And if so, how did you handle it?
At that point, when I was working there, I actually had to deal with a lot like that. And also other subsequent jobs in cable, as a cable provider and phone provider, what have you. And main thing was the corporate environment was very nice in that it just had me offset to, you know, our legal department, and because, you know, I was not qualified to deal with that, and made sure that they got the phone number that they could handle those issues very quickly. But only thing I was allowed to do or required to do at that point was put the account on hold, you know, turn off the, you know, the devices attached to it so that the fraud wouldn't continue. In both instances, whether it be, you know, the cable boxes that were attached to a number and picked up through ID theft, or, you know, the cell phones and tablets, what have you. And it was, both were awkward situations. But thankfully, legal teams were there on retainer and were able to handle that very easily and smoothly. I was able to just, you know, dial up the number right there with the customer and, you know, hot swap the call over because they were there ready and just handled it quite well. The customer that was there with the phone issue, what have you, we were there in the store, so I called it up and sat there with her and the store manager and just handled it with the legal team over the phone. And I was very shocked at how nice and how professional they were in handling it. And they even offered to follow up further as far as representing her in that issue.
Wow. Impressive. So now I'm also curious, one more question to Pinky, which is, being a CCDC participant, how often have you socially engineered your way into the other team's camp? And in what ways?
That would be against rules, and I don't believe in getting disqualified over crap like that. Have I done other things? I won't confirm or deny it.
Okay. Well, I just thought I would ask, not trying to get anyone in trouble.
Red Team has social engineered us, though.
Vesh, is that true? Has Red Team engineered, social engineered their way in?
Isn't that part of their job?
Technically, no. And it depends where.
Yeah, I haven't done it in a little while, but last I checked, there was that was a yes for forget what, though.
It's yes.
So, and I forget what year it was. But I don't think it was last year.
Last year, yes. At least at the regional Southwest CCDC, it was allowed because a guy got into every single room, including ours, and would try to sit down, plug in his phone to your computer, and then look for passwords and things like that.
Oh, wow.
We were the only team that realized, hey, this guy isn't actually allowed. He grabbed a white team badge, you know, someone who is allowed to be in the room, that was just lying around, came in, and we're the only one who confronted him and got him to leave.
Oh, wow.
See, and then funny enough, when we got to Nationals, he was a legit white team member for our room.
Oh, gosh.
So we actually had to get the, you know, organizers to come up and be like, is he going to do this again?
Oh, wow. See, now that's a good story right there. But, I mean, obviously this is someone who definitely has some gumption on their side. And you know what also took gumption? Releasing the Power Glove in 1989. And I'm telling you that because Nintendo Power Glove is back, sort of. According to an article from the Tech Times, as we move into our section called Gadget Prawn, there is a gentleman who has gone ahead and retooled their old Nintendo Power Glove. And let's just think how awesome it would be to be able to use a Power Glove to control a drone, because that's what they actually did. So this person went ahead, took the Nintendo-branded controller, and gave it new life by moving it into a modern context. Now, honestly, the customized device is nothing, resembles very little to the original hardware that was in the, at least the way it was built back in the 80s. So instead, its guts have been taken out and replaced with components that allow this person to actually fly a drone and remote control it with the glove. Now, if you thought you looked interesting doing VR stuff in your home, imagine how awesome you look out in a field waving your arms about like a loony to control a drone. I think that this will be the new, it'll be some kind of like better than history of dance on YouTube. I think this is going to be fun. Vesh, would you do this? Would you set up a power glove to remote some drones?
Why not? It's so bad. if I may pull a quote from Lucas Barton, the concept of being able to move your hand around of instead of stuff. Something like this is a long time coming. The only issue with having too much control is you might have a tendency to overcorrect. Which I've had very bad experiences with drones, like the DJI Phantom, by the way, comes out of the box in the most dangerous configuration available.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
We need to know more.
That you can pick it up and you can fly it, but it doesn't have it doesn't do the correction. So none of the waypoints, like its home point isn't programmed in, so it's not going to come back to you if it falls away from the signal.
Ooh.
And the other thing that is really terrible is that forward and backwards for that are not relative to you at all.
What?
It is relative to where the aircraft is pointing, and if you have seen the shape of a quadcopter, you can see pretty straight away where the issue would be something that's 400 feet up being able to see where the front.
Oh gosh. Oh, this sounds terrifying. So
yeah.
Are the DJI, are they not used in those drone races? Is that not a problem if the camera is facing in a, I mean, so do you have to adjust the camera to point in a forward-ish position? No, that's different.
It's not the camera. It's not the camera. It's the flight control. The flight control. There's a setting in the Phantom where you can take the where you can have the flight control say always keep the it moves relative to the handset.
Okay.
The if I push forward, it moves forward relative to the handset. Not forward relative to, you know, where the front of it is. So that's the problem is if I push forward and the front is facing left, it's going to go my left. It's not going to go forward.
Oh, sure.
So that's the issue. But, you know, how do you determine which part of the drone is facing forward? It's friggin' square, or it's basically a square box.
Oh, man. See, this is... So you got to definitely figure out your place in space, in relationally speaking, to try and make that work better. And it's actually, hang on a second here. There's an article that's trying to be evil. There we go. So I opened our next article and started talking at me and I could hear it. So there was just something so irritating about the idea of watching a drone come at you, bro, because you turned or tilted the wrong way with your controller mechanism, whatever it is, because it's so easy to get out of, you know, the correct orientation. Pinky, do you have a drone? I'm curious if you've experienced this too.
No, if I'm not even allowed in the kitchen, I probably shouldn't be allowed with something that's hundreds of dollars that I can crash within 5 seconds.
Wow. I didn't, we do not condone, nor do we blah, blah, the blah, blah of the blah, blah. Do not send us hate mail. Coop, do you have a drone?
Don't have a drone per se, but I do have a RC helicopter, and I'm trying to build my own quadcopter through a 3D printer.
Oh.
But, yeah, I don't know if it, you know, if it's, you know, heavy enough to require, you know, signing it up with the FCC, because FCC, if they actually looked at how I flew the thing, would take my card and rip it up all the hell just to save the populace from death from above. I'm hoping that the quadcopter will be at least a little bit more stable.
Well, you know. So I have a quadcopter. I registered it even though it's technically too light. But the idea is that I've accidentally, when I last flew this thing, I almost flew it into my neighbor's trees. It was awesome. It was scaring the cats. It was terrific. I don't even have cats. They're the neighbor's cats. That's how far off I was with this thing. Vesh, how good are you at flying yours?
I crashed into my neighbor's roof.
Oh, there you go. So you took it to the next level. Kudos.
Well, I also had an additional hardware shim on there too, and I think two leads touched, so it fell out of the sky like a rock.
Oh gosh. That's a little surprising, especially for the DJI, which has a very stable reputation.
It certainly does, but not when I guess a certain controller.
Oh well, there you go.
And you've never
what?
Which he's most frozen.
Why? That's why it's so damn dangerous.
Well, you know, that's half the fun of a drone, isn't it? And you know what's even more fun? Flesh-eating bacteria? No, maybe not. Why don't you explain more about this, Coop?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it fun, but CNN did report quite well on it. A survivor from it, flesh-eating bacteria survivor, shares her new body on, apparently, Facebook. But here's from the article. 4 years after a life-threatening bout with flesh-eating bacteria that resulted in loss of both hands, one leg, and her remaining foot.
Wow.
Amy Copeland is comfortable in her new body. So on Monday, she posted a picture to Facebook of her vacation in San Juan, Puerto Rico, smiling on the beach, scars and all. Along with the photo, Copeland posted, "It has taken me a long time to become comfortable and accept my new body. We're all made with imperfections, and there is so much beauty in our flaws. the scars and skin grafting build character. It's not about what you have, but what you do with what you have that really counts. And this caught my eye because, well, yeah, she has the same last name. I don't think she's a distant relative. I don't know, but she does have some pretty cool prosthetics. And one unfortunate thing I did find out after researching the article, her website, she forgot to renew her URL. Oh. So, yes, I responsibly reported it to her Facebook account.
Oh, good.
So that hopefully she'll be able to renew it. Instead, I could have easily renewed it for less than $20 and hijacked it for a year. But, yeah, no. We're gonna stay all white hat in this place.
Good guy, Cooper. Good guy, Cooper. Well done. Well done. It takes a lot of guts, like you say. That is an amazing comeback, really. To think and reading the details, it gets kind of a little gory in there for the less, for the ones who don't appreciate a little bit of squeamish description there. the gore factor being, notwithstanding, it actually is a really interesting article to see how far this person has been able to come back and be themselves again. I jokingly talk about, I wouldn't terribly mind being partly bionic in a leg or something like that. To actually have to do it and really live with it, that takes a kind of courage that is not common, I think. I don't know. What do you think there, Coop?
I don't know. She's doing pretty darn good for a 24-year-old, really. I can't imagine at that age dealing with this type of stuff. I can't imagine at my current age, dealing with this kind of stuff. Because I myself have suffered to a point where I thought I was going to be in a wheelchair and, have to have a prosthetic in one of my legs. But luckily, the doctor, saved it and reattached everything that was partially severed. But yeah, it just, this might be a fluff piece, but it does get the feels going.
Oh, it does. It does.
I don't know. How about you guys?
I don't know. I didn't see really any of the pictures or anything. I have a JavaScript blocker on and it seemed like it was going to be a video.
It was
video. Mm-hmm.
And it actually I would have written hung on mine.
I didn't want to watch the video. I wish they could have just explained it in the thing. Cause if you read the story and you don't see the video, you have no idea what the hell is. Oh, it's she had flesh eating virus. Why are flesh eating bacteria? Why am I? There's nothing in here that indicates, hey, you should see her prosthetics. That's nothing. It's not even in there. So right? It's just like flesh eating bacteria survivor shares new body. But in the reading of the story, there's no talk about what that body is. So yeah, this is like just piss poor. It's a piss poor marrying of the written word with a video. 99.9% of the time, I don't want to watch the damn video.
Well, there are actually some good pictures if you just go to the image sites, the image search engines, and just type the person's name, Amy Copeland, and you will see it's A-I-M-E-E Copeland. You can see several good pictures displaying the prosthetics. And
too much work. Too much work.
For further work, you could go to her Facebook and see all sorts of more stuff.
There you go.
Hey, Facebook.
There. Since we're not going to...
That's if you don't hate Facebook.
If you don't hate Facebook. Well, what if you're instead maybe not a fan of Facebook, but if you found that there were three ways that batteries could dramatically improve your life, Vesh, how would that be done?
Oh, man. Okay, so from money.cnn.com... I don't even understand why this news story was written. I don't get it because it's saying that, hey, here's ways that batteries can improve your life. If we had a battery that held more of a charge, your electric car could drive farther and you could talk on your phone longer. This is a statement of can anybody not wrap their head around that? If my battery lasted longer, I'd be able to talk on the phone longer. Yes, you would.
Well, wouldn't that just believe mean that you this didn't get the thinnest phone possible? Instead, get something more functional?
I think I was having.
Well, yeah.
So actually, I'm going to jump on. Well, okay, no, actually, I'll hold my comment because Vesh, you were still reading. Go ahead.
Well, I'm actually kind of done because I'm not done with this because I want to explain the difficulties in battery tech. This story was written just to write something. There's nothing inherent. America does not need to read this story. It's basically just saying 2 + 2 = 4. As far as like why we don't have this battery tech, this extended range battery tech, a lot of it has to do with the manufacturing, the engineering of batteries themselves. So there have been several attempts like A123, which was a battery. Mm-hmm. It was in the news because it was kind of a ripoff. Or it wasn't a ripoff, but yeah. They reportedly had something that they didn't, and they got a lot of government loans. And there was a whole they lied about the anode or the cathode material, I think it was. So in a battery, you have two sides. You have the anode and you have the cathode. And I'm pretty sure that electrons flow from the anode to the cathode. And that's, and they're taken into the circuitry. And the big problem is the construction of the
anode
out of material that is able to absorb items that are coming into it without expanding. And the holy grail is having for lithium ion batteries, having the anode be completely lithium, because right now it's a silicon mix, I believe. But the problem with lithium, its expansion qualities, as it expands and it cracks like old paint. So they need something, and some MIT guys were working to coat it in a carbon nano web, in order to make sure it retained its shape. But we're just not there yet, and that's the problem in battery tech, is that the battery technology and the materials involved aren't coming along at the rate that I think people thought they would. So instead of having better batteries, what we're having are more efficient phones, which is kind of neat, because for a while there, we thought that Moore's law comes up ways, right? So for a while there, we thought that, we're just expanding in space here and expanding this and expanding that. And then it turns out that we can have unlimited memory and unlimited storage. It's so cheap these days. But then it turns out that the things we want storage on the most, we tend to want to be smaller.
Right.
So the smallness of the device is driving the density of the batteries, which is driving the efficiency of the phone. So it's like, Moore's law holds once again. And I realize that that's a very broad generalization of basically, the amount of transistors on a silicon chip, doubles every 18 months. But that logic has held for several other things, including price per gigabyte, speed of a processor, speed of a processor relative to the number of cores, items like that. So now that people are saying, I can just make bloated software all day long, it's like, yeah, but not if you want the widest distribution possible, because you want it to be on a phone,
right?
And a phone demands efficiency. So, how many apps have we seen come up lately? Like, the Facebook app got hammered because it was using your battery up like crazy when it wasn't supposed to. So that's what that's why we got to look at these things. So efficient programming is still here, and it's here to stay, and it will always be here until we have unlimited scarcity of power resources such as batteries, which we're never going to have.
And that's actually a surprising way to go. I mean, Pinky, I think you heard something recently about a thing about the Moments feature, actually, didn't you?
Yeah, so I think I read this like yesterday or the day before, but basically what's going on is, I guess there's a feature of Facebook that I personally don't use, the Facebook Moments, and it was storing photos on your phone, or you're allowing good access or whatever.
Right.
And Moments is going away and forcing you to install separate Facebook apps, similar to when they forced you to install Facebook Messenger.
Oh, yeah.
But the problem is that if you don't install this app before sometime in July, they're going to delete all those photos off your phone without your permission. similar to the Google Auto Backup of Photos.
What? Why? In other words, if you don't take advantage of it, they're going to just delete it off, or that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't understand why they're doing that. I don't see why they can't just say, we're done. We won't mess with that album anymore. It won't be updated. We won't touch it. I wonder if you removed the permission from Facebook to touch your photos, if this would still, you know, hold true. Or is there some back door that they have that no matter what your operating system is, they delete those photos?
So now you bring up the other thought is, you know, the concept of the right to be forgotten. Because the Facebook, to my understanding, even when we delete things off the timeline or we delete them from our accounts, it's still available through Facebook's database. It's still stored there. And with the right search engine queries, it can actually be brought back up based on, I guess, metadata. So the idea that anything is going to get deleted by Facebook would be surprising at this point. That would be funny only because other things noticeably don't go away ever. So interesting. Very interesting. So I guess I'm finding that there is just so much surprising in the idea of that, almost as much as I'm finding it surprising that Microsoft has released a new piece of software that I'm hoping you might also talk to us about a little bit, Pinky.
Yeah, no problem. So this is from theregister.co.uk, stating that Microsoft has created its own free BSD image. Repeat, Microsoft has created its own free BSD image. That's literally the title.
Is the ground cold? What just happened?
So when you first look at this, this sounds really surprising. But if you've been paying attention to Microsoft and Linux history in the past, you know, if you just do a quick Google search of Microsoft Linux kernel, you'll see that back in like 2012, Microsoft was in the top 20 list of Linux kernel contributors.
Oh, wow.
So it's actually not that surprising. But to get into the article, just so we understand the context, it's not that Microsoft is spinning its own FreeBSD and it's going to be, you know, Microsoft BSD or whatever. It's not that. Instead, it's creating its own cut of FreeBSD 10.3 in order to make the OS available and support it in Azure. It's also going to be brought in. So I don't know how familiar everyone is with Hyper-V, but it's a hypervisor. This additional fork is going to be used to make it so FreeBSD is now supported in Generation 2 virtual machines. If you're not familiar with Hyper-V at all, basically it's like, you know, Amazon, I can't believe I just forgot the acronym.
AWS.
AWS, thank you. But, you know, it's something you host locally. It's more like ESXi. Just Microsoft's answer. However, there's two different types of virtual machines inside Hyper-V, Generation 1 and Generation 2. Generation 1 is the default. It provides support for like older hardware, and it's just been whatever you're used to Hyper-V. It's just the landmark. FreeBSD currently works under that. However, there's Generation 2, which allows you to, it supports Pixie boot by a standard network adapter. It boots from a SCSI virtual hard disk. It supports boot from a SCSI virtual DVD.
Wow.
Secure boot and UEFI firmware support. So,
major upgrade.
Yes. And currently FreeBSD is not supported in Generation 2. So they made this decision to remove the burden from FreeBSD Foundation because, like a lot of open source, they are only, you know, supported by whoever wants to contribute at the time.
Yeah. Well, then that's actually pretty amazing to see that there's going to be proper FreeBSD support, which runs half the infrastructure of the interwebs. So, I mean, it's awesome that it would actually be brought in. So it's about freaking time, I suppose we could say. But at the same time, well, you know what? I can't really say that. It's actually really cool that they're taking on the project themselves rather than relying on the community to do it separately. So kudos to you, Microsoft, for your virtualization team and for scaring the tar out of the rest of us. You know, tar.z, maybe, .gz, who knows, out of the rest of us as we all read on in surprise and maybe even mock horror that there is a Microsoft-made distribution of Linux. And will wonders never cease? Vesh, do you currently run any kind of Hyper-V, or what are you running for your virtualization platform?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I have a FreeBSD. I believe pfSense is FreeBSD based.
Yeah.
Yes, right? It is.
Okay. So I have it running on a Hyper-V server with, you know, that has a BitLocker enabled. So yes, I do run FreeBSD at home on a Hyper-V server for my firewall. One part of my firewall. So it exists. And I haven't noticed that there was a big issue with it, but I guess I'm just one user and my firewall doesn't take that much of a hit. So, you know, I'm guessing there's issue scale here, but what I'm excited about is that possibly if Microsoft donates to FreeBSD, maybe we can get S channel on FreeBSD instead of OpenSSL and the other garbage that they have on there. And we could actually have a nice secure cryptographic API on FreeBSD instead of OpenSSL 20 versions ago.
Well, come on, just use Libsodium, man. I'm kidding.
Or whatever. I mean, I know it's OpenBSD, but whatever LibreSSL, whatever the hell Theodorat has been shilling as the next big thing. So what I'm really excited about is you're combining Microsoft engineering with FreeBSD fanboys, and so who's going to start the argument on the commit? I mean, you know, if Microsoft is making a commit to the tree, I'm sure that there's going to be some, you know, friggin' fanboys on there. They're going, this is a terrible commit. You put your damn curly braces on the same line and you shouldn't have.
Yeah.
That'll happen.
Is there going to be a panel at the next Linux Fest?
You tell us. You're the one who's had our talk accepted.
That would be kind of fun.
Oh, gosh, Vesh. Oh, the troll factor, the Microsoft panel at the next Linux Fest.
You could get Vesh and a couple of Linux beards. I would pay to see that.
I would.
Well, while I sit there and argue for the fact, it's funny. Yeah, it's funny that, you know, Microsoft has had support for, very easy support for smart card and PCSC drivers forever, and you guys, I can't find a single library or tutorial out there that points me to the ability to put it on FreeBSD for login.
Don't please, because then now this is going to come up. You know, it's going to come up, and I have you to thank for it. So thank you. It should come up.
People need to know,
and Sciatic needs to moderate it.
Oh, yes. Nice. That's why drag me into this? I'm just a voice on the other end of this line. And speaking of on the other end of this line, we're moving now from our segment from Gadget Prawn. We're going to take a look in the App Attic, and we're going to start by asking our good friend Coop to tell us about why Russia is considering getting rid of a couple of different operating systems.
Well, according to the hackernews.com, it's got Russia to develop its own mobile OS. Last month, it was reported that the European Commission is planning to impose a record antitrust fine of about 3 billion euros.
Oh, damn.
3.4 billion US on Google for violating antitrust laws. Not just Europe, Google also lost an anti-monopoly appeal in Russia 2 months back against ruling for violating its dominant position with the help of its Android mobile OS by forcing its own apps and services like Google Maps, YouTube, and others on users, reducing competition. Now, to put an end to the monopoly of a major mobile operating system, Russians are developing their own mobile operating system to compete with Android, iOS, and Windows mobile OS. On the Minister of Russian Communication Ministry, Nikolai Nikiforov, last month about the initiative to develop a new Russian mobile operating system for which the Russian company Open Mobile Platform is hiring developers, testers, and security engineers. So Open Mobile Platform is developing a Linux-based mobile operating system for big business and privacy seekers who are looking for trusted mobile solutions. Now, the new mobile operating system will be developed on top of the existing Sailfish OS, a product developed by the Finnish company Jola, formed by the Nokia engineers, which is now registered in Hong Kong. So with that in mind, what do y'all think about this?
So I have to jump in, and I just want to quote a single line from the sailfishos.org website, which says, "Minimalistic Nordic design and regular software updates are the icing on the cake." I somehow feel that this is a crowning moment of achievement in the English language, that we can put that phrasing together as an actual sentence that's supposed to mean something to people. That icing on the cake comes from minimalistic Nordic design and regular software updates. Just saying, because they're talking all about all the awesome things that Sailfish OS can do. Smooth, fast to use, but I actually seem to recall that there are other things that we can buy that have very simple instructions, and things don't always go together as we expect. I kid much. But I'm that's not actually...
I thought IKEA was Swedish.
It is. It's a bad joke.
Whatever. It's the same. It's effectively now we're just arguing over different variants of the whitest people on Earth.
Oh, gosh.
So, yes. I don't really think anybody's going, "Oh, I confused a Swede with a Ouija."
Yes, and so now that I've insulted everybody, that's probably some of my worst there. Sorry. So the idea of actually Sailfish. But I thought Sailfish somehow, I need to look it up real quick. I've never actually used Sailfish. And anyone has, Pinky, have you used it before?
I have not, but I looked it up while Cooper was reading this. And apparently it's, the main goal of this is to be independent from existing US-based mobile operating systems. So I guess this might not make a lot of sense with us per se, unless we don't trust our own new, America-based mobile operating systems. But I mean, it makes sense because Europe is more privacy conscious than we are, so I'm not surprised this has come about.
But it runs Android apps.
Big
sale. It runs Android apps. So basically, this is it. So this isn't. All of those judgments are not because they enjoy privacy more. It goes back to, we've been trying to get money out of Google for years. The Europeans are broke. Every single country in there is up to its asshole in debt. And they're just doing this to these American companies because they want money. And this to Europeans, this is the easiest way to get it. I mean, they're not exactly used to actually earning money much anymore, considering capitalism went out the door there in about the, I think they had a brief period of time with it between like 1700 and 1710. And this is just another, I mean, they're, for crying out loud, they're getting an OS that runs Android apps, and they're going and suing Google for some type of intellectual property misuse or locking people in, when clearly the Sailfish OS has absconded with some type of IP to make sure that Android apps can run on it. It's all of this is just one stupid money grab, and I wish that U.S. vendors would just say, you know what, it's not worth it to sell here. I got to defend myself in court every 10 minutes because moving target. The French are suing. The Russians are suing. The French are suing for tax construction.
Yep, that's right. The French were suing. It was only 2 weeks ago, I think, we had that.
But they're going after Google. Yeah, exactly. Remember when people say, like, there's some notes here about a monopoly, of three competing companies, doesn't competition internal to a single company.
So and if you can understand that, kind of ladies and gentlemen,
to have two companies exist.
So yeah, a monopoly of three competing companies. How is that a monopoly?
Yeah. Yeah. So how's that? So three competing companies, then how is it a monopoly? That's Coop's question.
You can have.
Okay, we'll pick that up in a minute. So while we're waiting for that connection to restore, we're going to just briefly jump in and mention that I looked up on everyone's favorite site, Wikipedia, and yes, I used Wikipedia. You can get angry at me later. But it says that in the history and development section that the operating system is an evolved continuation of the Linux Mego OS, previously developed by an alliance of Nokia and Intel, which itself is built on MAMO, which was Nokia's old tablet infrastructure. So the MeeGo legacy is contained in the MIR core, in about 80% of the code, America. And the MIR name thus expands to MeeGo Reconstructed, hence MIR. The base is extended by Jala with a custom user interface and default applications. Jala and MIRproject.org follow a meritocracy. Oh, I can't even say it. It's a meritocracy. Yes, it's a Worcestershire cocracy. It's an Olympia Dukakis cocracy. No, it's a meritocracy, to avoid the mistakes that led to the MeeGo project's then unanticipated discontinuation. And on that English fail, I will throw back to Vesh and say, how are three companies a monopoly?
No. I was saying that three companies aren't necessarily a monopoly, and there are times when one company isn't necessarily a monopoly because there's intercompany competition all the time. A company gets big enough, eventually the units and the leaders of those units want a larger piece of the pie, so they're trying to collaborate against scarce resources as well in order to cut themselves the best deal. So you see a lot of this it leads to cartel busting, right? Where one salesperson or one group, one unit offers to sell something at a much deeper discount than what list price is, and that has the effect of driving down the cut. Because once there's secret pricing, right? That secret doesn't stay secret forever. Even back in the 1800s and even back in the 1700s, 1800s, keeping, you know, secret price lists doesn't stay so secret because eventually other people want to grab at that share of the pie. So that's all I'm saying about competition monopolies is there's not a set number of companies that have to be in competition with one another for there to not be a monopoly.
I get you. No, that makes sense. And thank you. That actually helps clarify a great deal. So, in looking at that risk then of struggling different companies, I'm very curious to see how this is going to shake out in the form of making money. Cause like you said, hey, this is something that if they can find a new market, get a toehold in a new way to get money out of Android without going to Google directly, that's going to be a really interesting story to see unfold.
It's not that they just want money. That's all they want is money.
Yeah, but you got to get there somehow.
Yeah, doesn't everybody want money? Got to pay the bills.
Yeah, exactly. But they prefer to get it by a judge's mallet, or instead of trying to make it themselves. And the Russians, for crying out loud, arguing over Google is anti-monopoly. I'm like, isn't your entire government pretty much run by one dude?
Yeah. Ouch. You know, yeah.
How's that monopoly?
And how long has he been president now? Putin? What?
Yeah. Doesn't the mafia own every single, I'm sorry, not the mafia, the NKV. It's basically the same thing. Run every single one of your natural gas reserves. You know, how is it that connected mafiosos or suspected mafiosos within Russia are all of a sudden billionaires because they've been given large swaths of oil and gas rich land to run? I mean, and then they're going to come after Google for saying, oh, you're too monopolistic. It's like, why? Because you guys are the only ones who are allowed to have monopolies in your country.
Wow. That's going to be actually a dangerous grab here one way or the other. But I want to try to move us along, I'm afraid, because I was very curious to know about how a mother saves a one-year-old's life while Siri calls for the ambulance.
Okay, so this article is actually from Sophos, you know, the antivirus and whatnot. And, of course, the article is Mother Saves One-Year-Old's Life While iPhone Siri Calls for an Ambulance. So, just so everyone knows, it's another feel-good article. You know, apparently we actually have hearts to talk about warm, fuzzy things like this.
Nice.
And first, the toddler's fine, fully recovered. Don't worry, this doesn't end sad. And this is not a sponsored advertisement for iPhones or baby monitors. So, what happens was, basically, this one-year-old child had been suffering from a chest infection and bronchitis. And those illnesses can make breathing very hard. At one point, the child stops breathing altogether. So the mother was watching the baby on the baby monitor when she saw the baby turn blue. She grabbed her phone and ran to the girl's room. But as she turned on the light, she dropped the phone. However, she did remember its voice activation feature, which is probably, as I say this, going to make my phone and Apple Watch go off.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, basically, if you ever need to know it, and I will say it just in case this happens to you, first you have to turn this feature on your phone, so please don't do this right out of the box. There's a feature in your settings, and you basically say, "Hey Siri." Siri will pop up and start listening. Okay, good, it didn't start up. I thought this was interesting because previously, this feature only worked when you had your phone plugged into a power source. Now, I suppose it works even outside of a power source. So, apparently one of the Apple upgrades, they made this better. That's awesome, you know, be aware of it in case this ever happens, but don't rely on it per se.
Well, somehow, I just...
Default can...
No, go ahead.
Yeah, default config out of the box now, I believe, is that Siri is enabled if you hold down the button, even if the phone's locked. It is not by default enabled if you just say, "Hey Siri."
I believe that's correct.
So now that we've caused several devices to go off while people are listening to this in the open air, I'm afraid that their self-driving vehicle has now pulled over to the side of the road to try and find the closest custard stand. There is the concern that you're going to say, help me in a moment of panic. And it's going to say, now playing help me by the Pile Drivers or something useful like that. Because sadly, I'm glad
Siri,
there's a good
call
story.
Call me an ambulance. Okay. You're an ambulance.
Exactly. Are you sure you want to change your name to an ambulance? Uh-huh. That's what this is. As for everyone that ever said, why is Siri call you iPoppy? You know, I mean, cause you can change it to say anything. So I'm concerned that people will get this somehow a little misconstrued. It could happen. Now actually, at least there is a good happy ending to this. And with all the things we have listening right now, I think I almost want to write a script so that I can have one voice activated digital assistant call the other and have them do some kind of clever bot interaction with one another while I'm not home, just to keep the people listening in the ceiling, you know, entertained. I don't know.
Was that like your chat ops for the day?
Kind of.
Okay.
Kind of.
Okay, Google, call Siri.
Yeah, that's right. And Siri should call my
Cortana.
Right, there you go.
Yes.
I'm telling you, they should have an argument over what to have for dinner. I think it would be a very funny live art piece. Vesh, can you help me code that?
Oh goodness.
I don't code anymore. I code very selectively now.
Selective coding
is too much. It's too much time, and people always want you to do more.
Oh yeah,
it's like it's better just to say I don't know how to use a computer.
Nice. Oh come on, you're going to tell me. So is that your failover now? Okay, so Pinky, how many people do you tell that? Like, do you actually play dumb about your computing skills now at this point?
Very often.
You just like have the shirt. No, I will not answer or fix your computer or answer your questions. In fact, what is that box with the magic blinking light?
Yeah, I need that shirt. And I do play that a lot, especially if we're at like Best Buy or whatever. I'm just like, nope, I'm not going to pretend. I don't want to listen to it.
Yeah. So Coop, I'm curious, how do you handle the ops when you go to a store, a commercial electronics store, and you want help with something?
First off, I don't ask for help there. The only help I'm asking for is, can you see if you have more in the back?
Nice.
Because, yeah, no. I've learned a long time ago, especially when I was working at Circuit City back in the day. I'll actually use their name because they're gone. And, yes, I was there during the whole spin down. As a fire dog technician. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's an embarrassing part of my life, and I don't like to talk about it. But, yeah, it was that was a fun time. And needless to say, I learned very quickly there are two-way streets of monotony. People came in not knowing what they wanted, and there were people there that didn't know what to give you.
Wow.
So, yeah, nobody knew anything.
Awesome. Well, see, at least now you've moved on to other things, and hopefully that's a part of your life you can let slide away if
forget.
You so choose. But Vesh, can you talk to me about how a new device is being used to seize money?
Sure. I'll even give you the headline from news9.com. Douchebags use new device. OHP. I guess that's Oklahoma Highway Patrol. Douchebags. We'll go back to calling them douchebags.
Okay, there you go.
They want to. So they're talking about, we're going to use these fancy new devices called NIRAD to take the prepaid cards that are being bought during the commission of a crime or that they think is a commission of a crime. They're used for crime or something, and they're going to be able to take them, swipe them, and then that account goes straight to the troopers. So,
wow.
Because of civil asset forfeiture laws, which are criminal in and of themselves, in that I have to, even if you can't prove a crime is existing, you can still take my assets because you believe they may be tied to a crime.
Oh, wow.
You know, like people have had all types of property taken from them, even if there is no way it could be part of the commission of a crime. I think is it Ron White had a really popular thing where he had his plane was confiscated or something, got it back. I forget the whole story. But these devices are able to take the cards, swipe them, and then they just go to a debit account. And the troopers are saying, it's not about the money. This isn't just about seizing cash. I'm like, well, then why are you making it incredibly expedient to make it a friggin' why are you so desperate to expediently deposit the cash, right? You don't know how much you don't know how much is on the card. You don't know how much you're taking off. Sometimes the cards don't list what the amounts are. You're just going to debit them for the maximum amount, shove it in there. Are you giving the guy a receipt? And what's the difference between doing that and just taking the card? If the card is so damn important, if that is the thing that is done during the commission of the crime, I mean, you don't take somebody's gun and then say, and then take the bullets out and say, the gun isn't suspected of a crime, but the bullets are highly suspect.
Well, yeah.
So that's... Yeah.
But, I mean, okay, so if you're seizing the funding to prevent malicious acts to be taken, so that's one thing. But, I mean, the article goes on to specifically cite, hey, they took a cancer survivor's meds away. I mean, that just...
Well, that's just one of a number of abuses of the civil asset forfeiture system, aside from the fact that it assumes guilt before proven innocent. I mean, that's the whole thing here.
Yeah, but that's the bug.
Not that anybody's interested in money, but the same reason why traffic cams, you know, they get a cut of the traffic cam money and the tickets there. The company that makes these, ERAD Group Incorporated, Asshole Group Incorporated.
Nice.
ERAD Group Incorporated. You guys are tools and you're douchebags for facilitating this, just like the douchebag cops. So then, and they take 7.7% of a cut of all cash seized. So if they're taking 7.7% of all the cash that is received, right?
So
is the person only getting back 92.3% of the cash because of the processing fee? I'm like, this is just so many levels of bullshit.
Well, this is one of those things where, you know, if your car gets impounded, I've had it happen, not impounded, it was towed once while downtown by parking it in the wrong spot. And you got to take that effective walk of shame and you're going to be paying some money. You're not paying like $5. You know, it's expensive to find out which lot it got dragged to and how much it's going to cost to get your car back. It probably feels kind of the same way if they're taking and swiping your card and maxing a card, or how much are they taking? Right? I mean, it says that an amount, but.
Well, I don't know how much it is, but the thing is with your car, somebody towing your car, you're parked in an area that is a tow-away zone, right? Like,
right,
it's
right.
Posted.
Supposed to be.
It's there. If it's not posted, you can go and fight that. But the thing is with this, is that they don't have to have evidence of a crime. They take it just in case. And instead of taking it just in case, they are just taking it, right? Half of these people are never going to see that money coming back to them. And if they are, and if they're proven innocent, they have to do the legwork to get it back. It isn't, I can't go back and sue the highway patrol you know, as part of like a big class action to say, you guys have been abusing the system for a while, so we're going to sue you out of business on this line of in this line of getting money. You can't do that because of like indemnity laws and items like that against suing the cop. For me, I would like to see the cop, whoever is executing the arrest,
right,
that cop is responsible for, like, they should be insured like malpractice insurance. So you really want to be a cop, you got to be insured. So that way, and take away this BS about I have to sue the police department. You know, the police department can aggregate funds and everything, but if I've got to sue one asshole cop, right, they're going to be a lot less likely to say, oh, well, you took his assets, his livelihood and everything. Okay, and you didn't have a valid arrest? Or he was found innocent later, and we look back and we see that you did a shitty job. Wow, guess what? He's going to sue you into oblivion.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Well, and I don't know how we're going to be able to pull that off, because you've got the legality here is huge and crazy. So I do actually have a question I want to direct about that, but I don't think we're going to be able to come to a good idea on how to answer it here. What I would like to do is ask, Coop, are you going to carry that last article, or am I going to look at this cellular project?
I think you are, really.
Okay. So then I would just like to move us to talk about how Google adds U.S. Cellular's network to extend Project Fi's coverage. So Google announced that it has added U.S. Cellular, one of the larger regional carriers in the U.S., to its Project Fi network. Now, U.S. Cellular joins Google's existing network partners T-Mobile and Sprint. And if you're not familiar with Project Fi, it's a program to deliver a fast and easy wireless experience in a close partnership with leading carriers and hardware makers and our users, or so it says on the Fi, that's F-I, .google.com page. So, back to the article. It actually says, thank you, TechCrunch, by the way, that what makes Project Fi is different from mobile virtual network operators like Boost or MetroPCS is that it doesn't just rely on a single network. Instead, it can switch between partners to select the best network available at any given time. The problem with this is that you need to use one of Google's own Nexus phones like the 6P, 5X, or Nexus 6 to use Fi, because other phones aren't able to perform seamless network handoffs necessary to make this work. So that actually makes me curious if the slightly older Nexus 5 is capable of this, or do I have to have, for example, the 5X to do that? So I know, because I'm asking actually in a way, because I have a Nexus 5, and I would love to try out Project Fi that way. Anyone who has an idea, why don't you go ahead and tell us online at on Twitter, and we are actually SATX Hackers on Twitter, and I'm hoping that you would come tell us about what you thought of the show and maybe even answer my silly question that if I wasn't lazy, you could say, here, let me Google that for you. But anyway, the idea is that I would be very excited to see if there is an expansion to this program, or rather as it expands with adding U.S. Cellular under their umbrella. Fi plan started about $20 a month, it says, for unlimited domestic calls and texts, with an additional $10 per gigabyte of extra data per month, but does not require any contracts. So Vesh, being that you're on, I think you said it was a microwave link. Would something like that work well for you if you just use that as a hotspot? Would that improve your coverage if you were running into connectivity issues?
Well, it's not going to be. I mean, the network isn't going to be as fast as the directional microwave link. I mean, that's so what all Google has done. So T-Mobile and other kind of carriers that are basically just aggregations of other carriers, and they're wrapped up in a portfolio of contracts, right? Google is doing something in tech-wise that some cell companies have been doing contract-wise for years. You know, it's not that it was a Boost and in some of these other areas. Yeah. They don't have their own towers. They make deals with other places to use access to their towers. So what Google's doing is kind of is saying, you know what, we'll just connect to a bunch of towers. By the way, this is all going to be in the baseband. There's no way that this is being processed by the main OS. This is going to be a joint function within the baseband where they're going through and detecting all these networks. So to have that offloaded to the OS is probably impossible for the seamless experience that they want. So, which kind of raises my haunches a little bit. Well, not haunches, but my ears a little bit, because I'm wondering if the best network engineering test item that you could buy isn't going to be a 6P, a 5X, or a Nexus 6, considering they have radios tuned to every single carrier frequency,
right?
Which you don't see in any other phone.
No, it's only the Google phones that actually seem to do this. Pinky, are you an iOS user or use Android? Do you have a Google device?
I'm an iOS user. I am not a Google device user. I'm not a fan of Google. I won't go to their phones. That's just me.
Wow. Well, then there's that. So obviously you're not going to be switching anytime soon. How about you, Coop?
Actually, I am carrying a 5X myself, but I am not on Google Fi-Fi-Fo-Fum. I'm actually on Cricket because I believe I don't travel much. If I did travel a lot, I would use Fi. But since I don't, I love the 5 lines for $100.
Wow.
You can't beat that because, you know, it's just nuts. You can even take the SIM card, stick it into a tablet, and use that as, you know, automatic, internet on the go there too.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Don't need a hotspot or Wi-Fi.
Nice. So I think I would actually use Fi if it was enabled on a device I had, based on the idea that, you know, I have one of the major carriers that I use on a daily basis, but in my neighborhood, it's not as strong as it was. I'm wondering if the recent storms knocked out a piece of gear. Either way, it just seems like it always seems like I never get the coverage I want in the area I'm in or where I live from the carrier I choose. And I've switched a couple of times, and it always seems to come back to the same thing. It's just, you know what? It's time for a femtocell. That's it. It's time to just hook up to the Wi-Fi and just call it done and not worry about this anymore, because it's just too frustrating otherwise. And Wi-Fi's become more ubiquitous, right? It's in a lot more places, especially the ones that say FBI Surveillance Van 7 and free airport Wi-Fi when I'm nowhere near the airport. Those are my favorite ones to connect to, really. So I guess I'll just be fine exposing my communications that way. And at least that way I can answer a phone call once in a while. Anyway, with that, we have reached actually the end of our rundown for this week, and we want to thank you so much for listening to us trample the tulips in the weeds, and feel free to reach out to us with questions, comments, or even, you know, offer a suggestion or two about what you thought about the show. And you can find us at SATX Hackers on Twitter, and we will actually push further into the weeds of security and other fine topics next time around. Thank you so much for joining us.